I thought about your question last night.
Well, thank you.
I thought about Janata's question as well. my thought was, to Janata's question, he said, how could Rukmini be driving the chariot? Where was Daruka? Daruka was driving the chariot. If you remember when they came, why would Rukmini be driving the chariot when they left? And my only thought was that perhaps there was something symbolic that a princess did when she was the one who made the plan. And if a princess was taken by force, she might be going, help, help, help. And if the princess was actually, it was her idea, then there might be some symbolic idea that she was driving the chariot. Literally, she wasn't driving the chariot. Daruka was driving the chariot. But something she did symbolically to show that it was a choice. And so, therefore, the soldiers didn't attack. The other king's soldiers didn't attack Krishna directly. We'll discuss yours after. So, we're continuing and we want to complete this pastime of the kidnapping of Rukmini. And we've come to the point where she has now been kidnapped by Krishna and he's taking her away. So although, as we said, we're not interested in the idea of subjugating the Leela, the pastime of Krishna, to a method of problem solving of our problems here in the material world, which is the way that the material mind tends to work. We tend to think, and this is why it's very difficult actually to read Leela pastimes. When I was a very young devotee, I remember I enjoyed reading the Krishna book, but I really couldn't fully relate to it because I had this sense that if I fully relate to it, I will materialize it. And if I'm not going to materialize it, how can I relate to it? Right? If I'm not going to think, oh yes, I remember Krishna, he's taking the chariot away, that's just like when my auntie and uncle blah, 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 something else. You know, I try to find something in this world that I can think, okay, that's just like this. And our process is the opposite. We're trying to hear about this and understand, oh, this is something like that. Not that is something like this. Because in the beginning, especially as a devotee coming from outside of the culture, where in the Indian culture, still, the problem is a different one. In the Indian culture, you've heard all these, and these are all stories, and your grandmother knows them all. But in the Western culture, you've never heard them, and so therefore they're fanciful. You know, they're somebody's imagination, maybe. This is how their materialistic mind is working. And so therefore, what we see is this world is so tangible, isn't it? Your relatives, you know them very well, especially if you're a married person and you have a baby or you have... It's very tangible. Your work is very tangible. Your body is very tangible. It's when there's an ache in the back, you notice it. And when you want to do something, it's very, very urgent, and especially if you have to go to the bathroom. It's very tangible. And Krishna is up there somewhere in a very hazy, fazy way, sort of far away, and sometimes I think about him, it's difficult to. It's so much easier to think about the things here. Look, I can hold this in my hand. I can't hold him in my hand. He's the Lord. So I can't measure him, control him, so he's irrelevant. Because remember, we're in this encapsulated universe, and in this encapsulated universe of the body, I'm the one in the center of my body, and you and you and you can have your own universes, that's okay, but don't try to interfere with my universe. And you can enter into my universe if you like, because I like you, and you should go away because I don't like you. And this is how the materialistic mind is thinking constantly. And we're absorbed in it, so absorbed in it. Just like when you watch a television show or a very, 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 very good movie, you'll see that it has been designed by the producer of the movie to just capture the attention of the average person with psychology, with color, with technology, everything. And so when an ordinary person watches it, they're like mesmerized. So this material world is like that. We should know this. It's like that. It's as mesmerizing, it's like a big mesmerizing movie, and I'm the star. And everything is centered around me. So when Srila Prabhupada speaks, many times he will say, everyone thinks they're the center of the universe. And I remember one time I was thinking to myself, I think I was listening to a lecture, and Srila Prabhupada said that, and I wasn't feeling very well on that particular day. So sometimes when you're not feeling very well, a philosophy is a little hard to tolerate because your mental power isn't so great. So I remember Prabhupada was saying, and everybody thinks they're the center of the universe. And I thought to myself, in my mind, I observed, my mind said, the center of the universe? I don't think I'm the center of the universe. I just feel like I'm miserable today. And then I stopped and I caught myself and I took my intelligence and thought, what does it mean to be the center of the universe? And then I was sitting, actually I was in a hospital, and I was sitting in a hospital bed. And then in my mind, I thought, okay, just see if you can project all 360 degrees around, like a circle around. What would you see? So you can sort of imagine as if you're on a chair that turns full circle. I see the house, I see the room, I see the window, I see the door, I see everything. And everything else that goes on downstairs, upstairs, on the roof, outside, is irrelevant to me. That's how we think. So I, because I'm looking through eyes, think I am the center of the universe, because I go 360 degrees and all I see is what I see. And this has to do with this idea that I'm autonomous within a material body, within a material realm that I have control over. And because I have control over it, I'm automatically inimical. By definition, I'm inimical to the Supreme Controller. Just like in the Mahabharata and in the Bhagavatam, we hear that Yudhisthira Maharaja wanted to perform the Rajasuya sacrifice, which is the sacrifice that's only performed when you become the sole top emperor of the whole of every province that you know. And to do that, you send out a horse, and if the people in that place, they accept the horse and they respect the horse's presence, and you come there and they offer their homage to you, that means they say, I subordinate myself to you. You are the higher ruler, I'm underneath you. And if you go to the next place and they don't accept the horse, or they capture the horse, that indicates I don't accept you as the supreme. And then what does that ruler have to do? He has to fight. He has to prove himself supreme. Because to perform that yajna, you have to have subordination of all. So for us, here we are in the material world, but we don't want to be subordinated by anything. We resist it like anything. Our senses, our body, we don't want to be under them. And Krishna, he's completely, we're subordinate to him at all times. But we live in avoidance of this. So this, as we were hearing yesterday, this is the asuric mentality. That Krishna, even he can be, that's okay, I don't mind if he can be, but he shouldn't bother me. Because I can also be, and I have everything I have, and I have a right, so he just shouldn't get in my way, because I've got a plan for my life. So this was how all these kings were thinking like this. They were thinking, and they saw Rukmini, she was incredibly beautiful. And we can imagine, if all the beauty in the world, all the most beautiful women, and the most beautiful scenery, and the most beautiful aristocratically made furniture, and the most beautiful clothes, and the most beautiful jewelry, and the most beautiful, beautiful things, was all brought together into one composite being, it would be stunning. It would be totally stunning. And that, and much, much, millions of times more than we can imagine, billions of times more, is what Rukmini was. And so when she walked out of the door of the temple, walking on her own beautiful swan-like lotus feet, and she just gently moved aside her hair, and out of the corner of her eye, not even directly, indirectly, she went, Everybody just went, like, shivers at their spine, and they all fell down. They couldn't control themselves. She was so beautiful. But she was only interested in one, because as we heard, there were two forms. Mahamaya and Yogamaya are the same energy. Just like you can have electricity for heating and cold. It's the same energy. When we desire to enjoy the material world, we're dancing with Mahamaya. When we desire to become connected, reconnected with Krishna, when that becomes prominent in our heart, then Yogamaya starts to act. But it's the back and the front, same energy. It's Krishna's energy of union. Which do you want? Do you want, you are Tatastha, you're in the middle. Do you have to take shelter? A vine doesn't stand up straight like a tree. The vine has to make its way around a tree. So which energy do you want to take your shelter of? And some people think, I'm going to be awfully clever and I'll take a little bit of this and a little bit of that and a little bit of this and a little bit of that. And so they're very divided, actually. It sounds good, but it's divided. And their consciousness is divided and they don't grow deeply anywhere. And this is a very contemporary thing. Have a little of this, a little of this, a little of this, a little of that. And so they're not actually, they don't become very happy people. But we don't want to become very solid, happy people, materialists. We want to learn how to become solid and happy and confident in our Krishna-related activities and eventually in our eternal relationship with Krishna. So for now, this material world is so tangible, so exciting, so dynamic. We want whatever we can find, whatever our tastes are, it's all here. And that up there is very light and airy-fairy and a bit invisible. It's very invisible, in fact. And it's kind of like just somewhere else. Not quite sure where. And Krishna consciousness and Srila Prabhupada are going to change that. They're wanting to make this up here so tangible. Krishna so real. Krishna consciousness so potent and so vibrant. And the material world that materialists are absorbed in is going to begin to look like a dream. And this is what Baladev is speaking about. This is what Guru Tattva is trying to do, to make this conversion. This is real. This is a dream. And most of us, perhaps we could have to say all of us, are still in the category that this is real and this is a dream. So we've got work to do to transform that. This is our business in this life, and maybe in many, many more lives as well. One time, I went to a place in Vrindavan that only people who go to Vrindavan regularly would know. It's called Prem Sarovara. Have you been to Prem Sarovara? Yeah. So I was there, and there were some very older devotees were there as well. And we had just been on the very, very first Braj Mandal Prakrama. It was 1986, and we were all wandering around, and I was a lot younger and much more nimble, and we had just come from Varshana, and Varshana is so sweet and happy, and you feel very buoyant coming out of Varshana. And we were walking by foot, and Prem Sarovara is about 10 kilometers, 8 kilometers from Varshana. And I remember as we were walking along, I was thinking to myself inside buoyant kind of state of mind. I was thinking, I wish I could get a little more grounded here. I wish I could really kind of like get serious. You know, I'm just like laughing and giggling and being silly. And we were walking along, chanting. My mind's just going here, there, here. And we got to Prem Sarovara, and we all came down by the side of Prem Sarovara, and one of the devotees was speaking, and he said, this Prem Sarovara this water is not water. It is liquid prema. And in my mind, suddenly I realize I'm so far away. I just see some water with kind of green things floating on the top of it. And he said, this is a liquid prema. And then he told the pastime of how Radha and Krishna were swinging there together and a bee came. And Madhu Mangal, and the bee was flying around because Krishna is so sweet, and the bee was flying here and there. And Madhu Mangal thought, I should get rid of the bee because he will disturb the pastimes. So he took his cloth and he went like this, and he got the bee to go away, and the bee flew in another direction. And then Madhu Mangal laughingly, he said, Madhu has gone, because Madhu is a name for a bee, but Madhu is also a name for Krishna. And Srimati Radharani was sitting right beside Krishna. And when she heard, Madhu has gone, in the intensity of her love, she thought, Krishna has gone. And she began to cry and cry and cry, where is Krishna? Where is Krishna? He has gone. And when Krishna looked at her crying and he's sitting there right beside her, he thought, her love is so intense that even when I'm here, she feels separation. So this is a very, very, very high level of devotion. So then this devotee said, now we should all bow down around the kund. We're all sitting, listening to the story. And it was so far above anything that I could engage my frivolous mind in. And he said, we should bow down here on the steps of this sarovara, and we should pray that sometime, many lifetimes from now, we can enter into these pastimes. And it was such a wonderful moment for me, because suddenly I felt like, okay, I understand. Many lifetimes from now, no problem. Because now it was like, okay, I've got some time to sort of get into this. And I remember praying there and saying, thank you so much, you've sobered me. Nothing was working but this, just to hear this beautiful pastime and then think, yes, many lifetimes it may take, but this is the sum and substance of Krishna consciousness. And so then I saw from there the rest of the prakram became very much more peaceful, because I wasn't just jumping around like I was having fun in the water, but I understood that Krishna consciousness is very deep water and we have to learn how to swim. So back to Rukmini. Now, the reason perhaps that Krishna inspired me, Radha Vallabha inspired me to tell that story, is because there's actually a difference between the love of Krishna and Rukmini and Radha and Krishna. In fact, as I said yesterday or the day before yesterday, Srila Prabhupada, I read one quote where he said, Krishna Lila means Vrindavan. Krishna Lila means Vrindavan. Dwarka and Mathura is Vasudev Lila. So Vasudev Krishna is an expansion of Swayam Bhagavan Sri Krishna in Vrindavan. And similarly, Rukmini and Satyabhama and the other queens of Krishna in Dwarka are also expansions of Srimati Radharani and the other gopikas. So Rukmini Devi is an expansion of the Chandravali, and Satyabhama is an expansion of Srimati Radharani. And so they perform as Krishna's queens. They're non-different, they're different and non-different at the same time. There's no material comparison. I can't give you an analogy. Except as Srila Prabhupada sometimes says, there's the sun up in the sky and the sunlight is coming into our room, and the sunlight is no different than the sun. If the sun was in the room, we would all be dead. The sun is coming into the room by the sunlight. They're the same and different. So Rukmini's love for Krishna has a different technical term. Sri Rupa Goswami gives the names. There are three different levels of prema for the residents, for the consorts of Krishna, and those who serve the consorts of Krishna. So the love of Srimati Radharani is the highest. I'm afraid I can't remember offhand the exact technical terms for these three levels of love. There's the love of the residents of Vrindavan, Mathura, Dwarka. Perfect, more perfect, most perfect. It's all perfect. Nothing is flawed here. But there is more perfect and most perfect. So Rukmini, she's being carried away by Krishna. All of the soldiers come running after on their chariots, the kings and so forth. And Balaram fights with them. And the Yadavas fight with them. And Rukmini is looking and she sees that the Yadava soldiers are being rained upon by arrows. And that these kings are coming from all angles. And not only that, there's a ghastly war that takes place. There's a ghastly war taking place, and we would just think, how ghastly. I was just reading the description, and it describes there are limbs, and there are hands without fingers piled up, and blood, and everything. I was thinking, this is awful. And then I thought, oh, okay, we have to understand this, because we have this concept, especially from a Christian background, that everything up there is very nice, and horrible things go on down here. But if we're thinking, oh no, this is reality and this is a reflection of reality, then we think, do you mean horrible things going up there? And then we have to ask, there must be a reality to the things that we call horrible here. And have you noticed that ghastliness is a rasa that's very attractive to materialistic people? You know, they go to horror movies, and if you pick up the newspaper, there'll always be a horrible story on the front of somebody being cruelly beaten or murdered. And on the news, and if you were to check the hits for which article is read the most, it's usually something quite gory. So there's something attractive about war and murder and crime, and there's something attractive. And it's not a primary rasa. It's not that we like that all the time, but it is a rasa. It is a taste. It's a taste. And so when Krishna kills like this, he kills inimical soldiers and so forth, it's transcendental. Nobody really dies. Nobody goes to hell. Everybody is liberated. But there is this chivalrous rasa is there in Krishna's pastimes as well. And this is important, because otherwise, in a Christian idea, or even in a Vedic kind of a moralistic kind of understanding of religion, you think God is up there, he's kind of good, we go visit him on the weekend in the temple or something like that, and the rest of the time we get really involved in our family and we watch movies and we read the newspaper and we do all of these various things and we're getting so much taste from there. And he's quite sterile. He fulfills our orders, right? We go there, please help me, I'm having a problem, please do this, please do that. And he just sends rains down, if he's really there, things to help us. But our absorption, as we said, this world is real and very, very tangible to us. But when we become more Krishna conscious, we begin to realize that actually, there being more tangible means that God has to have all these dimensions to him. Otherwise he's boring and we'd be bored. In the Christian concept, God and angels, and it's like someday and up in heaven you go and there are angels and everyone's good there. And everyone wants to stay here because it's more interesting. But if we understand the full range of the rasa, the taste, the experience of Krishna and relating to Krishna, this world becomes again paler. You think, that's just a reflection of that. Just see, if I like this, imagine what it's like there. And then our conception of Krishna consciousness becomes very, very, very full. And it becomes able to satisfy us enough that we can turn away gradually or immediately from materialistic ways of enjoyment, because they get in the way of this. And this is when your Krishna consciousness is really growing, and it should come for everyone. In the beginning, it's difficult, but it becomes more and more possible if we hear about Krishna's pastimes. So, a ghastly battle takes place, and Rukmini is watching, as the arrows of all those inimical soldiers are raining down on the heads of Krishna's army headed by Balaram. And she feels a little bit, you can just imagine, this is sort of, she's been kidnapped and look at this, you know, everyone's going to be killed. So she's feeling a little bit sad or sorry, a little bit uncertain. So she's looking at this, and Krishna picks up on the look on Rukmini's face when she's seeing all these arrows raining down on his armies. And he says to her, "My dear Rukmini, look at all the arrows and the wonderful soldiers in your army." Immediately he wants her to feel, this is yours. I have taken you. This is all yours. You are going to be my queen and these soldiers belong to you. Do not worry. They're such heroes. Nothing will happen. And then all of them, these kings, they realize that actually this is a sort of a useless fight. Sisipal is too downtrodden and unhappy because of the loss of his would-be wife to really be able to fight very efficiently, and they're all fighting with Krishna kind of on principle because he's their sworn enemy, and they're losing their soldiers and the Yadavas are winning, and so they retreat and they go back to Kundina. And they speak to Sisipal, who's very, very, very unhappy. Described in the Bhagavatam, it is like somebody who just lost his wife. And the reason that sort of sounds like, oh, that's fair enough, of course. But of course, he wasn't married yet. He lost his would-be wife, but he was just as unhappy as if he had lost his wife. And they gave him some philosophical advice, the superficial philosophical advice, where Jarasandha says, don't feel so badly about this. Pleasure and pain come. This is the way of the law of the land. You know, you will lose today, but you'll win tomorrow. Don't worry about it. I lost 17 battles, but I won one, which he didn't fight. You know, so be brave. And so nobody's very, very happy about this, but everybody goes home to their kingdom because what else to be done? But Rukmi is very attached to his sister. But you can see him, perhaps, if we're going to look on the material example, the exemplary level, that Rukmi is like the blind materialistic love of a blind materialistic family member. And a blind materialistic family member is fully and wholly selfish, completely selfish. No matter how much they give, it's completely selfish. So here he is, and he's thinking, Krishna has stolen my sister. I will not allow this to happen. I will go and I'll get her back and I will kill him. And if I don't kill him, if I don't get her back, I will not come back. And I guess for a Kshatriya, this is like a show of bravery, you know, like when a wrestler kind of goes like this, you know, and beats his body. It's like to say, you see, I'm so strong, now fight with me. But the reality is they're no stronger. They're building up their sense of spirit, but they're no stronger than they were before they gave their display of strength. So Rukmi feels now that, you know, I've made my statement and I've made my vow, and he's off to try to reclaim Rukmini. So he gets his soldiers together and he starts off. And as he's going along, the noise of his chariot is drowned out by the noise of Krishna's chariot. So Krishna can't hear him coming behind. And Baladev sees him coming and he has the soldiers ready, and Rukmi's soldiers retreat. So Rukmi's driving along feeling that, you know, I'm going to kill Krishna. And then he realizes he's alone. There's only him. And so he decides that he will verbally abuse Krishna and get him to stop. So he starts saying all sorts of horrible things to Krishna, shouting out to him. And gradually Krishna can hear the sound of his chariot over his own chariot. So he stops. And so he stops the chariot and he turns around and Rukmini is coming up behind and he's full of anger and so many horrible things he's saying. You're such a coward. You stole my sister. You have no right to do this. You're just a cowherd boy. How dare you come to our city and do this? And on and on and on and on. And so he's got two things. He's showering Krishna with his anger and he's showering Krishna with his weapons. Just about to shower him with his weapons. So Krishna, first he deflects the power of his anger with a big smile. He's not at all perturbed or not at all affected by anything that Rukmi is saying. And then Rukmi starts with his arrows. So he's shooting arrows at Krishna, and Krishna very deftly, with golden arrows with beautiful feathers on the end, he shoots like as if one after another, so fast. So fast you can't even see where they're coming from. And he immediately kills his charioteer, he breaks down his chariot, he destroys all his bow, he defeats all of his arrows, and he leaves Rukmi with nothing. And so Rukmi picks up another bow and he tries again, and Krishna does it again. And he does it again. And then finally Rukmi, his chariot is now broken, his bows are all broken, he tries with his club, he comes down and they start to fight, they're going to fight together with club and so forth, he tries all his weaponry on Krishna, and finally Krishna has thoroughly defeated him, he's got Rukmi, and he raises his sword and he's going to now kill him. And Rukmini is watching this. What does she do? Like an ordinary woman, it is described in the Bhagavatam, she acts like an ordinary woman. She jumps down from the chariot and grabs Krishna's feet, and she's so worried. All her jewelry is disheveled, her hair is disheveled. She grabs Krishna's feet and starts saying, "Please don't kill my brother." And so the acharyas analyze this. Why did she do this? She's the goddess of fortune. And he's trying to kill Krishna. And he was going to marry her to Sisipo. He didn't have any love for her. And he's inimical to Krishna. He's a demon. Why is she so attached to him? And Srila Vishwanath Chakrabarti Thakur explains that she was not attached to him. She didn't have the slightest amount of attachment to him or any of the other demons. But she had something else. She had a sense in herself that she is a sister, he is the brother, and the sister is like the embodiment of mercy. And what would people think if her brother was killed? And she was there and she didn't do anything. So at this point, the Srila Vishwanath Chakrabarti Thakur makes a very interesting point about this, that this is a kind of love. All her love was for Krishna. She didn't have any love for Rukmi. But she had this tendency in her bhakti prema to think of what other people would think. And this is absolutely not there with the residents of Vrindavan. Now it's interesting because I find myself sometimes, because I'm here as an earthly creature where we have to consider right and wrong and morals and how we should act and so forth. So I consider it quite wonderful that she was thinking of others and thinking of her brother like that and so on and so forth. Somehow or other it appeals to me. Because of my materialistic tendencies, it's from up, down, up, it looks quite good. You know, otherwise social behavior should be ruled by rules, right? Otherwise everything is lawless. But we should understand that there's a love way, way, way above that, that's like nothing down here. The root of the tree, you know the story? In Bhagavad Gita about the banyan tree on the side of the river, and the roots come down where? To the edge of the water. And then the roots come down in the water, and down, down, down in the water you come to the top of the tree at the very bottom. Tree top, bottom is here, up here is the same. So it's interesting to note that there's a statement in the English culture that says, ignorance is bliss. It's a saying. I remember growing up with it. I don't know what it means. But anyway, ignorance is bliss. Up here, this is bliss. Down here, it is the grossest kind of ignorance. So for the regulation of the material world, there must be rules and regulations, and therefore the Vedic culture is there. And as Kali Yuga increases, what happens is people become freer and freer and freer and indifferent to following any kind of regulation. They can do anything they want, anytime they want. They don't want to feel any kind of commitment to any kind of codes of behavior. And so we look at the world today, and you see that people can't stay married, children can't take care of their parents, children nowadays don't even consider getting married. Often they think it's much more convenient just to have relationships when you feel like it, because, and then there's children that don't want children all the time because they're a bit of a burden to have around. So much disorder and chaos is coming into this Kali Yuga, and it will just increase more and more and more down here. And therefore we see the good value of rules and regulations to regulate this. But up here, there is no sin. There is no selfishness. It is all for Krishna up here. So the rules and regulations are about here, and at the very top of the tree, there is love that just flows without any consideration of anything except Krishna's pleasure. And nothing else. And therefore in Vrindavan Leela, for those who have been to Vrindavan and taken parikrama in Vrindavan, you will find there is one place. There is Nandagram, which is the place of Nanda Maharaj, where Krishna was living. And you'll find about 2.5 kilometers to the east, you will find a place called Javat. And Javat is the place where Srimati Radharani lives with Abhimanyu. Now on the altar we have Radha and Krishna. Radha is always with Krishna, right? Everyone knows Radha belongs to Krishna. But they're not married. They're together, but they're not married like Rukmini and Vasudev Krishna. But in Javat, Radharani, Srimati Radharani, is living at the house of her mother-in-law. Mother-in-law? This is not part of our deity seva, that there is somebody else as well as Krishna in the life of Radharani. But there is a very mysterious tattva here, that Krishna appears in the form of, Abhiman means shadow. So in the form of a shadow, Krishna appears in the form of Abhimanyu, and he is married to Radha, and Radha never, ever, ever, ever even touches his shadow. But she has the sense of being married to somebody else. So for her to go and meet Krishna, for Krishna to go and meet her, is, you would say, on this lower level in the material world, is like shameful, because they're breaking the Vedic regulations. But up here, the love is so full that Srimati Radharani never thinks of anything. You can criticize me, you can do whatever you want, but my every atom of my being is for the pleasure of Krishna. So this is very, very, very hard for materialistic people to understand, and practically, even Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu did not speak openly on this subject. And basically speaking, Srila Prabhupada didn't recommend that we speak openly on this subject unless speaking to very serious devotees. So we should become serious devotees, so we can understand these mysterious things. Okay, I've got off the subject. I told you I'm from Vrindavan, not from Dwarka. Back to the pastime at hand. But actually, Srila Vishwanath Chakrabarti Thakur makes this point. This is not a completely off the subject. He says that this love of Radha and Krishna obeys no rules. And the Rukmini's love is not, it is not an imperfection that she's thinking of my dear brother who's a demon, but she's thinking, what will people think if I don't do anything to save the life of my brother? So she gets down and she bows down to Krishna, And she begs him, please, please, please don't kill my brother. And so Krishna, because he thinks he's like insignificant, he's like a mosquito, so why even kill him? So he rips a piece of cloth, he puts it around the neck of Rukmi, because he has Rukmi now under his control, and he holds the cloth up like this, with one hand with Rukmi, and then he takes his sword, which is very sharp, and he starts cutting. First he knocks off with his sword, he knocks the turban off Rukmi's head, which in itself is a disgrace. And then he takes his sword and uses his sword like a barber would use, and he starts cutting zigzag lines in Rukmi's hair. And as he's cutting, of course, he's cutting so close to the root, he's also bleeding. He's cutting, and it looks like sometimes if you get lice in your hair, they make zigzag lines. So the acharyas describe it look like zigzag lines, just like lice in your hair. And he cut his hair like this, and his mustache off here, and like that. And he left him bleeding and looking very disfigured and looking horrible. And Rukmi is watching this. So then he is looking, he's been defeated, he's been made look very foolish. And this is kind of, in a sense, like, it's practically worse than killing him. And if you killed him, it's over. He died in battle. But this is totally humiliating. So at this particular point, Balaram, who was nearby with the Yadava soldiers, he enters into the scene. And he sees what Krishna has done, and he sees Rukmini, who's all disturbed and very upset about everything, but not, as we said, only because she has an attachment for her brother, but because she's thinking this is not actually proper. So Baladev first, he says to Krishna, and this is where I began my Balaram Purnima from, when I opened up and I started reading how Baladev talks to Krishna, then he talks to Rukmini, then he talks to Krishna, and it seems so real, three-dimensional, that, you know, not just like a story, like there are three people in the room, you talk to this one and you talk to that one. And so it attracted my attention into the pastime and then into this presentation. So Baladev, first he talks to Krishna, and he says to him, Krishna, what have you done? You shouldn't have done this. And he chastises Krishna because he's older. He says, you have disfigured a close relative. And this is just like killing him. Now, what he's saying basically for Rukmini's pleasure is he is saying that what you have done is not correct. But what he's saying inside, what he's thinking inside is, he is thinking that you have done what is correct to be done, because he's such a rascal and such an enemy. So when he says you have disfigured a close relative, the close relative, he's saying a little sarcastically, because he's not actually thinking that Rukmi is like a close relative. But remember, this is a young girl, and she's just been kidnapped, and this is her new first experience in the family that she's going to marry into, so everything has to be done very sweetly. So then he turns to Rukmini, and he very gently scolds her. He says, my dear beautiful Rukmini, please do not be displeased with us. Nobody but oneself is responsible for one's joys and grief, because a man gets the results of his own deeds. So here, these instructions are very nice for us. This is what I was thinking at the time when I first read this, that now, you know, we cannot identify ourselves with the beautiful maiden being carried away and so on. We have to think this is Leela. But here is Baladev giving some directions to us who are lost in the material world, thinking of ourselves as our own kings, of our own universes. Now he's going to give some instruction that can help us to be released from this kind of suffering, which we've grown very accustomed to. So he says to her, he gently scolds her, and he's saying to her, what is this useless affection for this most wicked person who acted even against your own husband, acted against even Krishna. But he's saying it very gently. So he's just saying it in a very... So we can think perhaps when Srila Prabhupada says things to us, he sometimes says them very gently, but he's actually scolding us because we're so like ordinary people. We shouldn't be like ordinary people. Ordinary people are allowed to think whatever they want to think, but as devotees or aspiring devotees, we have to learn to think properly, intelligently, spiritually. And then after he's gently scolded her and he's chastised Krishna, he turns over to Krishna again, turns back to Krishna, and he says, Krishna, now he's going to give moral teachings. Please understand, there's a difference between moral teachings and spiritual teachings. They're not the same thing. Spiritual teachings are meant to elevate one up to here, and moral teachings are to create peace and harmony in the world down here. They're relevant, they're important, but they're not the same thing. So he tells Krishna, Krishna, a relative should never be killed. Even if it is warranted that he should be killed, you should not kill him. Instead, you should throw him out of the family. And he is already killed by just throwing him out of the family. So why kill him again? Now, this is a moral teaching. And this, Rukmini may be thinking, and the Acharyas say Rukmini is thinking, that she's thinking, yes, this is true, but your younger brother doesn't seem to follow this because, you know, he's disfigured my brother like this. And so Baladeva is saying, scriptures say that you cannot kill, but you may kill somebody if they're actually an enemy. So he continues to talk now to Rukmini. He says to her, the codes of sacred scriptures for a Kshatriya are so strong that one may, for the sake of justice, have to kill even his own brother. Because he told Krishna a relative should not be killed. And Rukmini is thinking, yes, but your brother, he hasn't, you know, look what he's done to my brother. And so he turns around to Rukmini and answers her doubt. But actually, when there is a fight, a Kshatriya fight, both parties, your brother and Krishna, have done the right thing by Kshatriya codes. They both tried to kill each other. That's what it means to be a Kshatriya. So he's speaking still moral codes. So now he's given a complete analysis of the whole situation. You shouldn't have done this, but sometimes you have to do this. So there may be extenuating circumstances. Now he turns back to Krishna again. And he said, because Rukmini still may not be convinced, he says to Krishna, Krishna, proud men, arrogant men, like Rukmini, they don't see any difficulty whatsoever in treating others terribly by offending them for the sake of a kingdom or land or honor or power. And Baladev says, but we should not do that. So then here we have to think that Rukmi was doing that to Krishna. So when Baladev is telling Krishna you shouldn't do this, Rukmini is listening to this. He's trying to say that Krishna was meant to marry you. And your brother did this. He was the one who, for his power and prestige, he interfered with the marriage. And as he had said earlier, he's got the results of what he has actually tried to do. And now he's getting more direct. He turns back to Rukmini, who may still be having some doubts. And he says, my dear Rukmini, your attitude is unfair. So sometimes I've seen Srila Prabhupada would do like this. When he was talking to a devotee who was a little disturbed, he would be very tactful, especially at first. In fact, I remember myself being the recipient of that kind of instruction, where Srila Prabhupada at first would be very tactful, empathetic, sympathetic. I know it is very difficult, this, But, and at a certain point he would start getting firmer with his instructions. Having given you your due sympathy, now he would start to become firm because he wanted to change your mind. He wasn't just a counselor, you know, in the modern conceptual term, who sort of makes you feel better about yourself and then you get on with your life. He wasn't doing that. Even in his empathy, he was waiting to change you. He was determined to change you because he knew what was right, and it was absolutely right. So he wanted to bring about a change in you. And this was somehow rather subtly sometimes intimidating because you knew that he wasn't just sympathizing with you. He was then going to tell you to do something and maybe you didn't want to do it. So then your resistance would become more apparent. So Balaram says, "My dear Rukmini, your attitude is unfair. For like an ignorant person, you wish good for those who have done wrong to your true well wishes, and they are also inimical to you." So sometimes we're like that. So then Baladev is saying that this rule in war to the previous one where he's telling Krishna that you shouldn't do things blinded by conceit, Balaram is saying, but in war, then somebody who is defeated has to be made insignificant. When Rukmini is feeling that that's not really fair, it's my brother, then he's correcting her attitude that he had come to fight with Krishna and you're siding with him. And he's saying that the good done by Krishna to your well-wishers and family, you think of as bad. He has made your brother look insignificant. That is his good, and you think of it as bad. This is an unfair attitude on your part. This is a biased view of you who are nonetheless wise. You are wise, but this is a biased view. This is not correct. What you're thinking right now is not correct. This is the position of Shastra, of Guru and Sadhu. They have come, if they're genuine, they're trying to change our taste. They're trying to change our view of reality. They're trying to convince us that this is tangible and real and this is an illusion. And we hold tight, tightly, this is real and that is a dream. And Sadhu and Shastra are going on and on and on this point. And therefore, oftentimes when we have some disturbance of mind, we don't want to turn to Bhagavad Gita. We want to read a self-help book that might tell us how to calm down our mind. Because Bhagavad Gita is going to tell you your mind is illusion. We believe it. So we don't want to hear that. We want to actually, how can I be happy here? I know I can be happy here. And Prabhupada was so callous to that. You cannot be happy here. And you would all benefit so greatly if you listen to Srila Prabhupada's lectures. It's even perhaps more, it enters the bloodstream more easily even than his books at times. Because his voice is also there. You can hear his intonations. You can become familiar with him and more as a person. Because if you learn to trust him as the doctor when he administers the medicine, you will become gradually, gradually, gradually very happy. So he says, so Rukmini is saying to in her mind, she's saying, I know that he's evil, but still I have an attachment for him. What can I do? And Baladev says, certainly for an elevated person like yourself, such an attachment is bad judgment. It is not proper. For worldly people, it is a natural tendency. But for those who think their body is for those who think themselves their body, there is such bewilderment. But there should not be such bewilderment for one who is in knowledge. Then Baladev starts now his spiritual discussion with her. He's talked morally, and now he explains that those who are bewildered see one Lord who is everywhere They see him in separate. They see him as many. Now, in this verse, it's a little complicated philosophically, so I don't want to go as deeply into this part. But he explains that for those who are in the material world, they see so many individuals all acting individually, and they don't see that there is one supreme person within everyone. They cannot see that. Because they don't see that, also you see that this person, he doesn't believe in God, and he's okay. And that person, he says, you know, I'm going to be a millionaire, and he's doing well. And this one over here says this, and I'm trying, struggling as a devotee, and I'm not doing so well, so it's not really fair. And they get away with it. And so many things, like children think, right? He got away with it. He took my toy. I didn't. And they quarrel with each other. But one who has actual knowledge realizes, this is Krishna acting in everyone. So I should not quarrel with anyone. I should find out what Krishna wants of me. If he's making me look very insignificant, like Rukmini was seeing Rukmi, there must be a reason, a plan behind that. Like we heard, there was a plan behind Maharaj Parikit dying. Krishna told him, now accept death. So this is a devotee. It's so high, isn't it? It's like going to Prem Sarovar and thinking many lifetimes from now I'll become a devotee. But in a refreshed way, not in a negative, sour, miserable way, like it's hopeless, but what a wonderful thing. And one day I hope I become that. It would be so nice. I look forward to that. So then he describes to her how the body has a beginning and an end, and it's composed of physical elements and senses and modes, and it's imposed on one by ignorance, and it causes one to experience birth and death. We establish various temporary body relationships, dedicate ourselves to great endeavors, concoct imaginary religions, and make noble speeches, all involved in illusion. He explains further that the soul never comes in contact with the body. It's never in contact and then it's free from contact. It never becomes even in contact. The soul never undergoes contact with or separation from unsubstantial material elements. The soul is the origin and the illuminator. This is us. We never come in touch with material elements. Do we feel like that? This is the questions we can ask ourselves. Have I got that realization? No? Okay. We've got some work to do. The soul resembles the sun. It is not in contact with the sense of sight. The sun is here. When the sun comes out, we have a sense of sight and we have the things that are to be seen. And the sun, then the sun moves in the sky and it disappears from our presence and it becomes dark. We cannot see. We cannot see the things that are to be seen. The sun had nothing to do with either of them. The soul has nothing to do with these things. The soul appears to be the body and the body to be the self. But they never have any contact, the soul with the body or the body with the soul. Therefore, there is no separation. So the example is given that the world is sustained by the soul's desire to exploit it. And we are determined to rebel and try to enjoy without the loving cooperation of Krishna. And this is what keeps the material world going. We had a question yesterday, does the material world keep going if we all leave? And the answer was yes, because there are so many unlimited souls who will come in and they will want the same freedom of choice, and there has to be freedom of choice in order to love. So even in the spiritual world, if you suddenly say, I want to go back and be a materialist again, you have theoretically the freedom, but it's not that people do that. It's not possible to do that. But it is possible to do it simultaneously. The freedom is always there. So Srila Prabhupada would emphasize that. Don't think that you lose your freedom. You get the fullest measure of freedom when you become free of the material understanding of yourself as your body. So then he talks about how birth is undergone by the body and not the self. And he describes it as how the moon goes through the full moon, as it was last night, and it goes on and on and on until it comes to the Amavasya, and you can hardly see the moon. And it's can some people think, they say, even there's a saying, the moon is dead, but the moon again starts to rise again. So he's explaining to her that you should not even think what the death means, the end of the soul. Death does not mean that. Then he tells her that a sleeping person sees objects and himself as fruits in a dream, and he undergoes material existence, but he has no intimate connection with this world. Now, these are all the philosophical principles that we've heard so many times. And when I was reading this, the day I was reading it, I was thinking, oh, these are the things that Bhagavatam classes are made of. And sometimes they get a little bit kind of like, can't relate to that, or I've heard that before, or and then I find myself, I tune out, and I think, this is just philosophy, and I tune out. And when I put this philosophy in the compound of the Leela, I found that it was a little bit different, because now it's Krishna and Balaram speaking to each other, and wow, they're speaking philosophy. They're speaking the things we hear in the Bhagavatam class. That's amazing. That's what they speak about. You know, they're actually, that must be interesting. You know, so I found myself starting to read in a little bit different way. Now, I may not be able to convey that to all of you, especially rushing through these verses. But if you get an opportunity to read and you get that, you put the subject matter of the philosophy about you're not your body and the soul is like this and so forth, if you put that into a context, for example, I'll give you a good example of this. One time I was in Vrindavan, and it was Ekadasi. And on Ekadasi in Vrindavan, there was a tendency, I don't know if they still do this, they would play a lecture of Srila Prabhupada. So I was visiting Vrindavan, I wasn't living there. Because if you're living there, you know, things go on in a day-to-day way. But if you're visiting some place, you want something special to happen. So I came in on Ekadasi. I didn't know that there was a lecture from Srila Prabhupada. And I sat down in the temple room, and they said, so it's today Srila Prabhupada gives the lecture. And I thought, okay. So I sat there, sitting there, and so the lecture began. And I'm in Vrindavan, and Vrindavan, Prince Rover, everything is so wonderful. Sitting, and Srila Prabhupada starts the lecture. It's not a Vrindavan lecture, it's a lecture. And in the lecture, very quickly, Srila Prabhupada starts speaking about you're not your body. And I actually personally had this experience. I had a pen and paper with me, and I thought, uh-oh, it's one of those lectures. This is really what I thought. And I was writing in the book, I wrote, I've heard this so many times. I've been a devotee for such a long time, 40 years or more, and I'm still hearing this. And I'm in Vrindavan where I'm supposed to be hearing higher things, you know. And I was writing this down, and I was feeling quite guilty, naturally enough, because it's Srila Prabhupada speaking. But this did actually happen for me. And so I wrote this down in my book, and I was feeling quite sort of uncomfortable. And after the class, I went to see Prabhuji, my husband, and I said to him, I felt so bad. I was in the temple room and it was Prabhupada speaking, but he was speaking about you're not your body, you're not your body. And I said, I heard that for so many years, and you know, he used to say it all the time, and I'd fall asleep when he said it, because I was so young and he was so high and it was too difficult and so on and so on. I expressed all my doubts. And he thought, and he looked very calm and very kindly towards me, and he thought, like, sometimes he will kind of look up like this, like he's thinking about something very deeply. And so I sat there fumbling, feeling a bit guilty, and then he looked at me and he said, imagine if somebody had something so wonderful they wanted to give you. They had something like pricelessly valuable, exquisitely beautiful, something just so incredible, and they wanted to give it to you. And they look at you, and you've got something kind of worthless in your hands, like some rubbish or something in your hands. And so they're holding it, and they say to you, put that down, and I'll give you this. But you see the value of, you've got a broken piece of wood or something you've been playing with, or some kind of a little gimmicky game or a PlayStation, and you're like, wow, this is so good. And they keep saying, put it down and I'll give you this. Put it down and I'll give you this. And they keep saying this to you because they understand the value of what they want to give you. So he said, what would you do if you were in a situation where the person needs to understand this first, and then you can give them this? And I listened to his words, and I just suddenly saw Srila Prabhupada in a completely different way. And then later, it was later, I listened many times to Srila Prabhupada's lectures, and I heard him continuously. If you listen to his lectures, when he's not speaking strong philosophy, he's speaking Krishna this, Krishna that, Krishna this. And I began to see, yes, he wants to give me Krishna. And I want to say, listen, let me keep on my body, okay? I like being my body. You can give me Krishna as well. And he's going, no, no, you need two hands to hold on to Krishna. Put this down. And I keep saying, oh, he keeps saying that, he keeps saying that. But when the penny drops, why he's saying it and what he's saying, then when my intelligence becomes mature enough, I put it down, glad to put it down, and thank you so much for what you're giving. So this is how we have to be as devotees. We have to be developing, improving. And if it takes time, that's okay. It may take time. But we have to see where we're supposed to be going. And of course, it's more intelligent to go there quickly and not go there very, very slowly. But some people, it takes time. So here Baladev is speaking, this transcendental knowledge. And I believe that this part of the Bhagavatam is meant for us. So then he tells her, therefore, with transcendental knowledge, dispel the grief that is weakening and confounding your mind, and resume your natural happy mood. So he says, please, he's saying to Rukmini, my dear princess, do not grieve like an ordinary bride. So then Rukmini has heard these instructions, and as we said, what she is releasing is the sense that people will say that it is not proper that I did not do something. She's not thinking, this is my brother and I love him so much. She's not actually afflicted like that. But she became enlightened and forgot her depression and steadied her mind by spiritual intelligence. This is also for us. She became pratibodhita, is the word. It means enlightened. And by her buddhi, or her intelligence, she steadied herself. She gave up, in other words, the conception of thinking, what will people say? And she became happy and pleased that actually Krishna had come and delivered her. Rukmini thought, Rukmi, and as on the other side, while Rukmini was very happy and peaceful, Srila Jiva Goswami tells us that Rukmi, he thought the instructions of Balaram were more painful than the disfigurement given by Krishna. Now that struck me when I read that, because I thought that's the materialistic mind. Like when Srila Prabhupada is saying, you're not your body, you're not your body, I'm thinking, oh. Materialistic mind is going, oh, this is painful. But the spiritual intelligence says, thank you. And then that subject is finished and we go on to the next. But the materialistic mind says, no, I'm going to go and try and enjoy it this way and that way. And again, you have to say, you're not your body. So when we ourselves become freed of that instruction because we're now trying to accept it, then we go to the next lesson. And we go to the next lesson. And if we keep falling back, we have to keep hearing the same thing. And you'll see in a class, there'll be so many people listening and everyone will pick up on a different thing. because Krishna is within, as with Parikshit Maharaj, he's your friend. So he will alert you when there's something that's meant for you. And it will be on all different levels according to the eligibility of the hero. And some people, he will say to them, why don't you walk out the door, there's nothing here for you, and they'll get up and they'll walk out. It's not for you, you're in the wrong place. So you see, Krishna is there. And then sometimes if he says that, you are supposed to say, hang on a minute, this is for me. And you walk back in again. Because we have to say, actually you're correct, I'm not due any of this, but I know the value, so I'm going back in. This is the spiritual intelligence defeating the mind. So Rukmi could not really forget anything that took place. He couldn't return to his kingdom. And Balaram very kindly, do you know what he did? He had a barber brought, and the barber completely clean-shaved Rukmi, shaved his mustache completely, shaved his head like he'd just been on pilgrimage, just to save a little face. And then he sent him off, go. And while he was leaving, all the soldiers of the Yadavas shouted all kinds of abuse at him. You rascal, you this, you that. And they let him go in an insignificant way, and he never forgot this. He never forgot this. And it's interesting that these instructions upset him more than what Krishna did. Because later, we'll read in the Bhagavatam, that it was Balaram who killed Rukmi. Because Rukmi's inimicalness never ever went away. And he arranged a situation to humiliate Balaram. And Balaram became angry. And that was the end. So he shaved him and sent him away. He was insulted. And he never returned to Kundina. He made his own city called Bhojataka, which means the place where Rukmi experienced misery as a result of his vow to offer Rukmini to Sisupal. Bhojataka. And he stayed there. And then Krishna brought Rukmini gradually to his Dwarka fortress. And then there was a marriage arranged, a beautiful marriage, described also in the Bhagavatam. So many wonderful arrangements were there. And even Bhishmaka was invited to please come to this wedding. And he came. He didn't bring his sons with him. He came by himself. He was a little bit ashamed. He didn't know what was going to happen, but everybody met him with warmth and love and affection. And he was very happy because in his heart he actually wanted Rukmini to marry Krishna. And so many of the other favorable kings, different dynasties that were ruling in different places, they all came and made this marriage a wonderful success. And from there, we will not continue any further, but Rukmini had a beautiful son called Pradyumna, and later he had a beautiful son called Aniruddha. And this was Krishna's grandson, and then he had Aniruddha had a son called Vrajanav, and Vrajanav was the only one left of the Yadu dynasty after its destruction at the end of Krishna's pastimes. And he alone came to Mathura, to Hastinapur actually, to Delhi, Indraprastha, and he was crowned the king of Indraprastha at the same time that Parikshit Maharaj became the king of Hastinapur. And it was he, the grandson, great-great-grandson, who uncovered or rediscovered all the places of pilgrimage that are there now in Sri Vrindavan Dham. So he has a very special connection with the residents of Vrindavan. So thank you for your patience and tolerance and hearing everything. And back to your question. Yes? I asked my husband your question. He said, the question was, what is the symbol? What does it mean that, you know, when Rukmini was on the chariot, nobody fired arrows because Rukmini wanted this? What does it mean for us? And he said, he was thinking his way, he said, it means that when the Supreme Goddess of Fortune and Krishna wish to be united, no one can stop it. And I thought from the other side that we were thinking, when we willingly get on the chariot of Krishna's instructions and want to surrender to him, he will take care of everything. He will take care of everything, and we should not fear it. And so let me read you one last quote. quote from Srila Prabhupada. This is to allay a doubt. If I serve Krishna, who will take care of me? Has anyone ever thought like that? I think all of us think like that. If somebody may argue, oh, if I completely engage myself in the service of Krishna, then what to do? How shall I live in this material world? Who will take care of my maintenance? That, says Srila Prabhupada, is our foolishness. So first of all, please think for a minute if you're a bit foolish to think like that. Now, this will immediately arise many questions. If you ask to think that you're foolish, you'll think, hang on a bit. But, and many buts will come up. But what about this, and what about this, and the temple, and the that, and the this, and the that. But beyond this, the temple, and the that, and that one, and this one, and this one, and that one, try to have a look up in the sky and see that the whole universe is being maintained by Krishna. Forget the temple and my life, and this one, and that one, and this one, and that one, like a little chessboard. But have a look at the whole universe, and Krishna is maintaining everything. And I want to surrender to him. He's not going to maintain me. Does it make any sense? If you serve an ordinary person here, you will get your maintenance. You will get your wages. So you are so foolish that you are going to serve Krishna, and he is not going to maintain you? Yoga shemam vaham yaham. Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita that I personally take charge of his maintenance. Why don't you believe it? Now there's a question for us all. Why don't we believe it? Why don't you believe it? Practically, you can see. That means faithlessness. Now here's Balaram coming through. All the nice words have been finished now. It's very direct. That means faithlessness. There is no reason. Suppose I am serving some master here, a so-called master, and he is at once paying me wages. Here are your wages, $25, $10, or whatever it may be. At once he's paying. And I am going to serve the Supreme, and there is no maintenance for me. And then Prabhupada said, as only Prabhupada can say, oh, what a foolishness. So there's something for us to think about. We're thinking, I can't give more time, I can't surrender more, because I have to maintain what? My universe, intact, as I want it. So I can't. But we can. So as soon as we take to this, then everything is all right. But we have to take to it very seriously. This is called abideha, with all seriousness. And then everything is all right. It is such a nice thing. Everything is all right. This is the promise of one who can see. He's promising us who are blind and worried and so many other things, anxious and concerned about future, he's promising us everything is all right. This is the mercy of Krishna coming through Srila Prabhupada, who is actually representing Sri Baladev Prabhu. All right, I will stop here. Thank you for your tolerant, patient hearing, and we have a couple of minutes only for questions. If anyone has any, yes, sweetie.
I guess this is a misconception, so I was just wondering if you could clear the misconception. Generally, the misconception is that Balaram is always a very angry person, but that's not correct. Like, he curses Romahashana. No, not, I think it's Romahashana
Sutta. Yes. Yes.
And he also in the Krishna serial that you see when I was young, Balaram was always the first one to get angry. So this misconception is there that Lord Balaram is an angry person, which is not correct.
It's not correct. But Krishna can become angry also. Anger is a rasa. You see, here we think anger is not a good thing, right? It's not good to be angry, so you should stop being angry. We'll get rid of anger in the world, and then everything will be peaceful. Shanti, you'll never get rid of anger. Even in yourself, you'll never get rid of anger. You have to learn to dovetail anger, to become angry for the right causes, and not only for the selfishness of me and my universe, but to become angry at myself when I'm a nonsense, and to become angry when I see in myself that I'm doing something that's not right. I should become angry at that. And when I became angry with that, then I shouldn't say, okay, now I'm going to destroy things, because I'm not Balaram. But Balaram is the Supreme Personality of God. He's the second, he's the expansion of Krishna himself. So he's all attractive, and one of his features is he becomes angry. But his anger is not unrighteous anger. He doesn't become angry whimsically. So materialistic people, when they make series about Krishna's pastimes or Rama's pastimes or Ama Chitrakata, you know, and so on and so forth, they have materialistic conceptions that they're impregnating in their production. So therefore, as a devotee, you see something, you know, oh, they only grasp about 1% of the actual reality of the subject matter, because they can't enter it. And that's very enlivening to see, because it can increase your faith in Srila Prabhupada. Srila Prabhupada goes deeply into subject matter that materialistic people can only just scratch at. So if you think, okay, I got these conceptions from a materialistic source, somebody who isn't fully realized in understanding, let me remove them by reading, find out for yourself, then get the Veda base and look up Lord Balaram and read all of his pastimes. You know, he also drinks Varuni. Just imagine that. We say no one should, no intoxication, no this, that, and our God drinks, my goodness. So to the Christian upbringing, or even the pious Hindu upbringing, these things are like inconceivable. They can't understand them. They're just like not possible to understand. They think that these people have some strange concept of God. And why do they think like this? Because they say this is reality. That's heaven up there. We go up there after we get free of here. And I'm struggling with all of these vices here. They're absolutely none of them up there. There I'll have no temptation whatsoever. I'll just be free and shanti. Right? Shanti. I'll have shanti. The Buddhists want shanti. Everyone wants peace, freedom from anxiety. But look at this. Here's the tree. And there's the impression, the reflection of the tree. And the highest thing in the material world, just at the borderline of the water and the reality, is shanti, the mode of goodness. And the lowest thing in reality is shantaras. Because in shantaras you have shanti, but no service. There's no variegatedness. There's nothing to capture your emotions or your attention or even your mind. So shantaras is the appreciation of the greatness of God without any service. Then comes dasya. Then comes sakya. Then they go on, up and up and up. And Krishna kills a demon every day. Do you think there's no anger involved? He becomes very angry and he throws some demons up like this. Balaram throws the Nukasura around. But this is up here. And this is a materialistic conception from down here. Do you follow? Yes, Prabhu.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Vijay, on one hand,
yeah,
we realize that the Krishna consciousness, the highest is the conjugal relationship between Radha and Krishna.
Yes.
Which is confidential.
Yes.
And it is not accessible to common man.
Yes.
But on the other hand, ours is also a preaching moment.
Yes.
Like introduced by Srila Prabhupada, where
yes,
we go to a common man and we
yes,
talk about Krishna consciousness.
Yes.
So if you see really there is a bit of a contradictory thing. So how do you link this both the ends?
Well, it's like if you're going to, you open an education institution, right? In India you open a school. The first year you have only beginner grade. And the next year you have 2 years, because those beginners have gone up a year, and now you have new ones and you have the next. And the next year you get more new ones and you have now three grades. Until you go up, 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 until you have all the grades and still new ones are coming in. So what you're teaching up here is not the same as what you're teaching down here. You're expecting these ones to go up as well. It's not like you're saying up here we have this and down there you have that. But there's a gradation of the degree of knowledge. And the degree of knowledge rests on conceptions, right? The most beginning conceptions. Do you know what the most beginning conceptions that you teach in primary school are? Yes, exactly. A, B, C, D, E. We saw in the Vrindavan Gurukula, we had boys coming from Nepal that were 16 years old, 17 years old, joining the Gurukula. They could do nothing more than sit in a classroom with the little boys and learn A, B, C, D, E. Because they couldn't read a book until they knew A, B, C, D, E. And in maths, what are the basic conceptions? Yeah, you must know what they mean. So if I hand a little child, a five-year-old child, I hand them a very high knowledgeable book, or even a simple book, I hand them a book, they can't read it until they've got those concepts in place. So Krishna consciousness has to be somewhat systematic. Not that we can make it as systematic as a school can be with little children, but there should be a systematic presentation of knowledge. So if I walk out, for example, on the street and I'm going to talk to somebody and we're talking about God has a girlfriend, they have to have all that other knowledge first. So the Srimad Bhagavatam, it starts at the beginning, and Bhagavad Gita is the A, B, C, D, F, G. So Bhagavad Gita is so important. You know, I used to think in my immaturity, Bhagavad Gita, it's elementary school. You know, I'm still doing elementary studies. You know, nobody stays in baby school forever. But then I realized that's a foolish way to think, because everything you learn in the elementary school is the basis of everything else that you're learning. It's all based on that. So the ABC means all the concepts are in Bhagavad Gita. So Bhagavad Gita is exciting, if you understand that. That I'm learning my ABCs and now I can read. And then when you read the Bhagavatam, it's easy to read. Because you've already got these understandings in place. You're not your body, the Supreme Personality of God is like this, I am this, I am this, I am this. So many statements are there. And then, once you've got that in place, you've got in place, okay, I'm eternal, he's this, he's this, he's this, he's the all-powerful. And then beyond the all-powerful, we start to hear that not only is he the all-powerful, but he also has relationships with his devotees, and he has relationships that are love relationships. They're not just based on knowledge, like this, in reverence. And then we're coming closer, and we go to Vrindavan, and we hear about the cowherd boys, we hear about Mother Yasoda, and the love of Radha and Krishna comes next. Even in the Bhagavatam, it comes in a chromatic order, And then when you come to that point, and you have all the other concepts in place properly, then you properly appreciate the pastimes of Radha and Krishna. It's done properly. But if you jump from nothing to the top, what will you get? You know, and people in Kali Yuga want to do that. And therefore Chaitanya Mahaprabhu comes and he gives the Maha Mantra, which is Radha and Krishna. And he says, just chant this mantra. You don't need to know what it means. Don't worry, just chant this mantra. Harinama, Harinama. Chanting, chanting, chanting. We get our japa beads. Chant. So we try to get people to chant first. See, and then systematically, as they have more and more capacity, the material things are starting to move out, then we can start putting things in. And so consciously or unconsciously, a preacher thinks like that, if they're experienced. That, you know, now we can speak about this, now we can't, and so forth. And then you come to, because this is like what God does at home, you know, like the president, you know, the modern grossness of the materialist is that they would like to know what the president does privately all the time. It makes a big, you know, big article. But it oftentimes makes you think, oh, he's just an ordinary man. He just does what I do. So first you have to know, no, he's so powerful. He has this, he has this, he has this. And isn't this amazing? He also has these wonderful, loving pastimes. And they're up here, and you're down here. If you haven't been trained properly, aren't you going to think that this is down here? Where I like things? Isn't it natural? until you've gone through this process of elevation. So purification has to be there. Is that okay?
Okay,
thank you. One more, yeah.
Is there an understanding about how with the material world, it's always going to be here, these people are constantly coming. Does that mean then that as devotees are always trying to go back to the spiritual world, that we are in danger of coming back down again even after we've gone back up?
No. Doesn't mean that. It means that inherent, because not that people are always coming, it's that souls are always coming here. So souls that come here, they have a different kinds of bodies, but they always, with inherent in the soul rather than the body, is always this freedom, because we're tatasta, we're in the middle. We always have the freedom to go this way or go that way. When we go back to the spiritual world, it's not that that freedom is pulled away. Because Krishna, I heard Srila Prabhupada one time say, he will never, ever, one thing that's like fixed, he will never interfere with your free will. And sometimes we want to become zombies, you know, like dulled out because it's too hard. And we think, why doesn't he just force me to love him? Just get rid of all the temptations and just like force me. And Prabhupada says, this is not love, this is force. So he's not attracted to that. So we have some responsibility. We will stay here as long as we want to stay here. And when we go there, if we want to, we can come back here. But it's unlikely that anyone would want to. But if you want to, you can. That's what Srila Prabhupada was emphasizing. You never lose your free will, because it's essential for love. To be able to say, I have something here, I could give it to you, or I could give it to you. And I choose to give it to you. And you say, oh, thank you, because I chose to give it to you. I just wasn't somebody said to me, take that and give it to her. And I give it to you, I don't feel anything. But I could choose to give it to you. So similarly up there in the spiritual realm, but Krishna is so all attractive that it's not like souls are falling all the time. It's not like that. That's a kind of a childish conception that we carry from speculating with the pieces as we're trying to put them together, because we have no idea what all beautiful, absolutely beautiful is, or absolutely loving, and therefore we settle for this world and its paltry little kind of trinkets, and we think, I'm pretty lucky, I've got a this or a that. But if we actually had an idea, then we would be running to get there. But Krishna doesn't give that until we start to show some quality that we want him, and then he reciprocates accordingly. So some work has to be done by us, and for that work we need the help of Balaram, because he's so kind and he gets angry even at Krishna. Krishna, look, this one's trying so hard, come on. So we want that help, we need that help. He no nitai bine bhai Radha Krishna Paite Nai. Without the help of Lord Nityananda, you cannot actually obtain Radha and Krishna. So we need that, we want that, and therefore we embrace these instructions, even though they go against our own lower self, which is fighting with Lord Balaram. In essence, we're fighting with him, but he doesn't mind. And Srila Prabhupada didn't mind. He said, I am very patient. So we take to the process, we do the best we can, and we have our shortcomings. We all know our own personal shortcomings. We continue with the practice. We continue, we try to find good association whenever we can. We try to become good association for others, because then Krishna, he nourishes from within. And we try to keep going on this path. And I see personally, Keshava Prabhu, what was the first year we came here? Yes. 2001. We've been doing this now for 11 years. And I see personally 10 or 11 years, and I see how the devotees have grown and grown and grown and grown. And if somebody comes, or you go and see somebody's child once a year, you'll see how the child is growing. But when you're at home with your own children, you don't notice it, because it's imperceptibly going on. So with each other, you might not notice the advancement, or with yourself, you might not notice the advancement. But somebody who comes in once or twice a year, they can see the advancement. So you should continue and be very, very determined as possible. Thank you. I know we're running over time, so I'll have to answer your question separately. All right, thank you.